Today's Teisho is on case 32 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 32 is entitled Joza Stands Still. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, a thousand eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought, and all Nen actions are controlled. Is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Truth is manifest everywhere. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. See the following. Main subject. Jojoza asked Rinzai, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojoza stood still. A monk standing by said, "Jojoza, why don't you bow?" When Jojoza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse. Inheriting the spirit of Dansai, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the yellow river run through. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. A number of people came right from the start, quite a few people today. I know that people work very hard during the week, and also that you're tired, it's Saturday. But there's something really wonderful about these Saturday sits. It is true, you know, you get up, it's awfully early for a Saturday, and come in and sit down and do meditation for many hours. That's really a wonderful experience, really wonderful purifying of body, mind, and heart. If you weren't able to come at 7 and you came at 9:30, this practicing together is really very precious, you know. Being able to sit with other people, generally speaking, makes one's practice deeper. It's really remarkable how much deeper it is. So, you know, everybody has a hard time getting up on a Saturday. Long week, a lot of stresses, a lot of work. Coming in here and sitting together is really precious, really wonderful opportunity. It's easy to forget just how really remarkable this is, you know. So today the Teisho is on this koan about a man named Jojoza. And Jojoza is like a very senior monk in this temple where Rinzai is teaching, Linji. And Jojoza's been practicing for years and years, and he can't wake up. He just hasn't been able to break through to his true self, his true nature. This scene describes a moment where he's finally able to break through. He says to Rinzai, "Look, basically, I've been practicing for years and years and years. I've been getting up every Saturday coming to sit, right? I've been going to Sesshin, I've been doing all this stuff, and I still haven't had Daikensho, I haven't had my great awakening." So it's not a trivial question, it's not a philosophical question. It's a real question from his heart. You know, one of my friends is a poet, and he has given his life to poetry. His name is Mark. And I met him when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington, and he was He was already a poet. He had published several books of poetry. And he was really a devote. He lived the life of a poet. You know, he was really devoted to poetry. And he had a couple books that he had published. But you know, if you want to know the truth, poetry books generally don't sell at all. It's true that there's a few poets whose work sells well, but America is full of really excellent poets who put out these books, and they're inexpensively published, and there's nowhere for the books to go, you know, basically. There's a small, maybe thousands, but not tens of thousands. There's a small readership for these books of poetry. And they get published, and in very small numbers, you know, like 300 books or 100 books. And there are little journals that publish poetry. They're poetry magazines or literary magazines, and they have circulations like under 1,000. And my friend Mark would publish in these journals, and his poetry was just beautiful. And he would publish these little books, and they would get printed up by a couple hundred, and he would have them in boxes in his basement, you know, basically. And yet, you know, he's been a poet all his life, and he's lived this life. And I have the feeling that, like so many poets, you know, he's really wished he could be discovered. You know, that somebody would say, "Oh my gosh, this is the next Robert Frost. This is the next W.S. Merwin, you know, who's famous in the poetry circles, but not very well known outside of poetry circles. Somebody like Frost has really made a big splash in the larger world. So I think my friend Mark would love to be widely read and loved. He would love to have school children read his poetry in anthologies in school. And that would make him very happy, I'm sure. So he's been a servant of poetry all his life, but it's really a difficult life, you know, because there's been no recognition. Not really. And I have a friend who's an artist, you know, and she has been an artist all her life, and she has served art faithfully, you know. Basically, I think she wishes that, you know, somebody would come along and to one of her shows and say, "My gosh, you know, this is the next Georgia O'Keeffe." I think she's been waiting for that moment all her life. She's 65 years old now, so it's probably not going to come. You know, so if you think about these kinds of stories, you can imagine what somebody like Jojo Za is like, yeah? Because he's been in this temple all his life, you know, he must have gotten excited about Zen. And it must have been really magical for him when he started out. And so much did it move him that he became a monk, you know. He loved Zen. He believed in it. He trusted in it. And he gave it his life. And he got up on Saturday, every Saturday, for 50 years. And he went to Sesshin for 50 years, and so on and so on, you know. And he served Zen well, and he served the Dharma well, but he hasn't had his great awakening. So he's in that kind of a place, you know. It's like I started out with great enthusiasm, and I have real love for what I do, but I don't seem to have had the breakthrough. So, you know, everybody has that in life, you know, sooner or later. I think everybody, even people who get Academy Awards, wonder why they only got one Academy Award, you know, that kind of thing. Or it wasn't the right one, you know, or they're not as good as the other Academy Award winners. So anyway, Jojo Za's like that. He's a senior monk. He's given his life, nothing has happened, and he's in that place, you know. And so he comes to Rinzai and he says, you know, what is Buddhism all about? You know, I started practicing long ago, I've been faithful, I've been doing all this stuff, and I haven't had a breakthrough. And Rinzai, you know, understands this is like a very important moment. This is like crucial. This guy's been stuck for 50 years, basically. And Rinzai jumps out of his seat, and it says Rinzai jumped out of his seat, seized Jojo Za, slapped him, and pushed him away. And Jojo Za's like stock still, right? He doesn't get mad. He's just stock still. You know, it's like, what's that all about anyway? And then a monk next to him says, Jojo Za, why don't you bow? So it's like Rinzai jumps up, slaps him, and he's frozen. I mean, Jojo Za's frozen. He's stock still, like almost like in a trance, right? And the monk next to him says, why don't you bow? And when he bows, he has this breakthrough experience, this great awakening experience. So what is this all about? You know, Rinzai, you know, we practice in the Rinzai tradition of Zen. I myself don't really like to make distinctions. Rinzai Zen or Linji Zen and Soto Zen or Cao Tong Zen, they're all just Zen. And even Zen is really not Zen, it's just Buddhism, right? So it's very important not to make a lot of these distinctions. Soto is wonderful, Rinzai is wonderful, they have different ways of practicing. And if people are too fussy about this, I think they're really missing the forest for the trees. But most people, Rinzai is really not well understood in the United States, and it's not really very widespread. Rinzai teachers are not very common in the United States. Last night, we had a beginner's meditation, and we had some new people. And they, if you remember the first time you ever did meditation, they had a very difficult time. They came here and they were very enthusiastic. You know, one person got here very early, and they were really eager to give it a try. You know, really excited, and it was very hard for them to get through 25 minutes. One guy, poor guy, he was moving every 5 minutes. He couldn't get a comfortable posture, and I could see them, you know, struggling. I'm sure you can remember your first time sitting, how difficult that was. But when I was explaining to them what to do, I asked if they had any questions. And usually people say, no, I don't have any questions. And this one woman said to me, she said, what's the difference between Zen and Vipassana? And I had never been asked that question before. But I think it's a really interesting question. You know, Vipassana is mindfulness meditation. It's based on the idea that you should calm the mind, stabilize the mind. With calming the mind or stabilizing the mind is called shamatha. Shamatha. And basically, there are two aspects to Buddhist meditation practice. One is shamatha and one is Vipassana. And the Buddha said these both go together. They go together. So you calm the mind and you stabilize the mind in a very highly focused way. And then you focus on an object of attention. That's the Vipassana part. In Chinese, this is called stopping and seeing. Stopping and seeing. Vipassana is based upon calming the mind and stabilizing your attention and then focusing on moment-by-moment awareness. So typically this is your breath. You're watching your breath. And then people who do Vipassana begin to branch out after they watch the breath, and they begin to note all of their bodily sensations from moment to moment. So basically you're noticing sounds, or you're noticing hearing, you're noticing sensations in your body, and you're just noting each of these mental events as they arise. And you just get better and better and better at noting what's arising from moment to moment. This is really pretty much Vipassana meditation. And practitioners of Vipassana get very, very good at this. You know, they can stabilize the mind and they can be very, very aware of what's happening from 1 second to another, one instant to another. The mind can only focus actually on one thing at a time. The mind is really only able to focus on one thing at a time. So, you know, you feel the pain in your knee, you hear the fan, you feel your tongue, you know, then you feel the pain in the knee, then you notice your butt on the cushion, etc., etc. And they become very, very, very good at like registering from moment to moment all of these different sensations that we normally ignore, you know, and they become very, very good at noting this. Eventually, their consciousness becomes very refined. You know, they're able to pay attention to the whole mental stream for long periods of time. This is Vipassana. This is actually not what the Buddha taught, actually, if you read the Pali Sutras. It's not the kind of meditation the Buddha taught. He simply taught meditation on the breath. Nevertheless, it's a very effective method. Zen is actually quite different from that, even though it has a Vipassana dimension. We start also by stabilizing the mind and entering shamatha. So we watch the breath until we become very calm and focused. And then we watch the breath and watch the breath and watch the breath until we can enter samadhi or undivided awareness. Undivided awareness. This is just like Vipassana. But then after we can enter samadhi, after this preliminary stage, in Zen we do what is called mu meditation. Mu. This is emptiness meditation, so called. And emptiness meditation is really about activating the power of the unconscious mind. Unconscious mind. There isn't really a discussion of the unconscious mind in Vipassana. Now, Vipassana produces fully enlightened, fully awake people. So I'm not criticizing it. It's their method is moment-by-moment awareness. But the Zen method is quite different. The Zen method is Vipassana, but something else. It's activating the extraordinary power of the unconscious mind. You know, there's a temple in Japan called Tenryuji. Tenryuji. And on the ceiling of the temple is a dragon. This is a typical Chinese dragon. It's magnificent. If you go online and you type in Tenryuji, and you type in dragon, you'll get all these amazing pictures of this on the ceiling of their, basically their zendo. Is a dragon, and it's a big circle. It's a circular design, and the dragon's coiled in a circle. And I myself love dragons. You know, it's very cool, all the scales. You can see all the scales and the claws. And the dragon is looking very wild and mysterious, you know. And he has a pearl in his claw. This is like a very Chinese idea. But the pearl represents enlightenment, and the dragon is holding the pearl in its grip. So this is very Zen. This is like a representation of the Zen view. The dragon is the unconscious mind, and in Zen we believe that the power of the unconscious mind can be used to wake people up. You know. This is rather different from Vipassana. Many people understand that there is this thing called the unconscious mind. You know, that we have an unconscious mind, and it can do extraordinary things. You know, last time I talked about this case. Where I was reading a magazine coming back from Europe this summer, And it was celebrating the Olympics, the British Olympics. And I mentioned this, I think, last time, you know, that there was this boxer who was training during World War II. These were the World War II Olympics, and there wasn't enough food. And all the athletes couldn't get enough food to really get a decent decent meal, you know. And this guy, he used to get so worn out, and he would have a bread with jam on it to give himself energy. And then he went to the Olympics, and he said he had to fight the world champion. And he said he remembers sitting down in the chair, and the next thing he said, next thing he knew, he said to his coach, "Okay, when do I fight?" And the coach said, "You just fought." And the guy said, I remember absolutely none of it. Absolutely none of it." And by the way, he won. He became the world champion. But all unconscious. It's like something happened to him. You know, he didn't even remember going into the ring because this deeper mind took over. And this is not so unusual. People understand that this exists, you know. I remember reading years ago, and this was in like a respectable, it wasn't a tabloid, you know, it was a real newspaper like the New York Times, which always tells the truth, by the way. So it must be true. It was the New York Times, and it was a story about this guy. There was an auto accident, and a car was on this little girl. And he walked up and lifted up the car. You know, it was like, it was impossible, but he did it. And afterwards, they asked him, "How did you do this?" He said, I don't remember doing it. You know, these events happen. You know, also, you know, creativity often happens from an unconscious place. I don't know about you, but I'm a writer, and I get stuck. You know, I'll work on something, I'll be writing something, and I'll get myself into a corner where I don't really know what to do. I've contradicted myself, and I don't know how to work my way out of this contradiction. You know, I wrote something, and I sent it out, and the editor said, "I completely disagree with you. You know, I really disagree with your argument here." And for a long time, I've been thinking he was just wrong, and I was right. But recently I was meditating and I suddenly realized, oh my God, he's right. You know, he's right. Now, how did that happen? You know, sometimes I'm stuck. I'm trapped in a contradiction. I go to bed and I get up and I meditate. And next day, I know what to do. I know how to solve this problem. I start writing again and I figured it out. You know, this is quite common. You know, people, I was reading about this physicist who said he sleeps 12 hours a day. And by the way, he's like a famous physicist. And he said he sleeps 12 hours a day, and he said, "I do most of my work while I'm sleeping." And it sounds like baloney, right? You know, but he has these problems he's working on, and he goes to sleep. And when he gets up, he's much closer to an answer. He feels something is happening while he's asleep. Now, I'm totally sold on this. You know, there are many stories of artists who work with their dreams and find all kinds of solutions to their problems. There's a famous story of the chemist who discovered the, I guess it's the benzene ring, how these carbon atoms, and I don't remember my chemistry very well, but he was stuck. He couldn't figure out how these particular atoms linked together in this molecule. And he couldn't model it. And he went to bed, and in his mind he saw all the little atoms as dancing figures holding arms. And when he woke up, he wrote it down, and he had solved this problem that was so difficult for people to solve. So you know, there is this power of the unconscious mind to solve our problems and open things up for us, you know. And sometimes it's capable of extraordinary responsiveness. Now, the dragon in Japanese and Chinese culture is really a symbol of this power. You know, the dragon can fly up to heaven, or it can go to the depths of the ocean. And it's this, it can go anywhere. It can overcome any obstacle. You know, sometimes when I sit, I'm really tired, you know. I especially at night, when I sit down on the cushion, I sometimes doze off, you know. But sometimes when I sit, I have these experiences of like extraordinary energy. I don't know if this has ever happened to you. But I've been doing meditation for like 35 years, and sometimes I'll get up in the morning and I'll sit, and I just feel this tremendous energy. You know, and I think this energy comes from tapping into this unconscious mind. You know, normally, we're very locked up. We're very fearful and unnatural. You know, we live in the discriminating mind. You know, the discriminating mind is the mind that's constantly second-guessing itself. So, you know, basically, you know, I do this too. I do this all the time. I'll give a talk. I'll have to give a talk, you know, and I'll give the talk. And you know, sometimes after the talk, I'll ask people, "How was that? Was that okay?" And you know, I'm looking for their approval, and I'm hoping to get it, you know. And then I might go away thinking, "Oh, that could have been such a better talk," you know. And of course, if you think that way while you're giving the talk, it'll be a lousy talk, you know. Usually, it's a much better talk if you just jump in, right? You know, we second guess ourselves. We are constantly trying to please others, and we are constantly afraid of making mistakes. You know, if you sort of watch yourself go through the day, I think you'll notice how often you're sort of monitoring yourself, or checking yourself, you know, and kind of keeping yourself in line. I think it's quite natural for people to be anxious about their self-presentation, to be always a little bit insecure, and always quite restrained, you know. So this is actually very tiring, very tiring. You know, if you're constantly saying yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, all day long, it's exhausting, right? You want to say yes, but then you have doubts, and then you think, well, maybe it's no. And you want to say no, but then you have doubts, and you think, maybe it's yes. This is arresting and inhibiting. You know, and I think what happens on the cushion is that we get beyond that way of thinking. You know, we get beyond that kind of mentality. And when we do, there's suddenly this great release of energy. We're not policing ourselves anymore. We're resting in this unconscious certainty, kind of like an unconscious certainty. You know, I do think most people are rather deeply neurotic, you know. And I think this was true in China also, you know. You know, China was quite a stratified society, a lot like ours. You know, very small number of people became educated elite, like very, very, very tiny, maybe 2%. I was reading something by a Chinese scholar, and he said that if you pass the imperial exam, it made you the equivalent of a millionaire. You know, so passing the imperial exam meant your life was going to be wonderful. And not only your life, but the life of your whole family. It would open all these opportunities up to your whole family. So, you know, people in China, anybody who could afford to in ancient China, prepared for the imperial exam, and that meant knowing like all of this literature, all of these treatises and poetry. So, you know, basically, we see in the modern world, Chinese people are very, very good at school. You know, very good, they study very well. And this has been going on for thousands of years, you know. In ancient China, you know, basically, if you could afford to educate your sons, you educated them. And your goal was to prepare them to pass the imperial exam. And if you did get the, if your son or did pass the imperial exam, no daughters at this time, it would be like the whole family would be in a much better position. You know, opportunities would come your way, wealth would come your way, distinction. So there was fierce competition for this, just unbelievable. And of course, only a small number of people would pass the imperial exam. And most people who took the exam failed the exam. So, you know, China was full of people who aspired to be in the elite and they had failed. A little bit like Zhou Jouza. And they went through their life feeling like failures. So, you know, in ancient China, if you were a peasant, you felt a bit like a failure because you couldn't read and you couldn't even get close to the imperial exam. And if you were a normal educated person, you felt like a failure because you didn't pass the imperial exam. And if you were in that 1%, we have a 1% too, by the way. If you were in that 1%, you felt like you were a winner, right? So most people felt like losers in Chinese society. And Rinzai was quite aware of this. You know, he used to say, in yourself, there is a dragon. He called it the man of no rank, the person of no rank. And what he meant was, there's a kind of power inside of you that you can trust absolutely and that can overcome any obstacle and solve any problem. That's what he said. And that was his teaching. It sounds so impossible, right? It sounds so impossible. But Zen is all about, or Rinzai Zen, is all about tapping that power and trusting that mind. You know, sometimes we get in these situations where it just seems like there's no way out. There's no solution. And then, you know, somehow we solve it. You know, the mind has this creativity. The mind has this ability. We just don't necessarily trust it because of our socialization. In our society, too, you know, there's a 1%, and most people feel like they haven't made it, like they're losers. I think that's true. I think even people who are winners feel like losers. We're always second-guessing ourselves. We're always doubting ourselves. But, you know, Zen is all about tapping that part, that deeper mind, which is imperturbable and has supreme confidence, you know, supreme confidence. Now, this is supreme confidence is very far from who I am, I have to say. I occasionally have met people who have extraordinary confidence. You know, I just am amazed. And I am waiting for this movie that's coming out about Franklin Roosevelt. There's a movie coming out in December. It's called Hyde Park on the Hudson. But Franklin Roosevelt is one of my heroes. Because Roosevelt was this man who had incredible self-confidence, you know. He was from a very wealthy background. He pretty much trusted himself. He wasn't brilliant, wasn't a brilliant guy, but he had this incredible, people who knew him said, you know, I don't know where it comes from, but he has this incredible self-confidence. And it wasn't arrogance, he just trusted himself. You know, he had polio, he got polio, and everybody said, well, that's the end of him, his political career is over. But actually, he didn't think it was over. You know, he learned, he tried to overcome his polio. He tried to develop his muscles, and when that failed, he would wear these big, heavy braces to hold himself up. And he would give speeches, political speeches, behind a podium where people couldn't see his crutches. And he was a galvanizing speaker. If you ever see an old tape of Roosevelt speaking, he has this great self-confidence, you know. We had in the United States this total collapse of our society. And Roosevelt used to speak, and he was just so confident that everybody felt better. He gave this speech where he said, basically, the economy had fallen apart, and he said, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. You know, now that's a crazy thing to say, right? We have nothing to fear but fear itself. And he was really saying, fear is in our minds. Fear is in our minds. He was really saying to Americans, trust yourself. Trust yourself. And it was astonishingly effective. I think he was somebody who, for some reason, just had this extraordinary trust in himself, you know. And I think Zen is all about cultivating that trust and getting away from that self, that second-guessing mind, the second-guessing mind. You know, if we stay with the second-guessing mind, we become ill. We become mentally ill. You know, we can never make a decision without being plagued by doubts and fears, right? And spontaneity is almost unimaginable, right? This is human. This is so typical, and it's very typical of our time. I was reading this article the other day about the prevalence of depression. And I was reading this psychologist who said, you know, people who are... who fall into depression are suffering from, how did the psychiatrist put it? They said, learned incapacity. That means you've learned that you can't do it, right? You mustn't do it because you would be bad, or you can't do it because you're stupid or you're a loser. But they were saying people fall into this learned incapacity. And it's paralyzing. You know, in other words, when you encounter an obstacle, you don't think you can overcome it. And you just give up, right? You give up. And they were saying this is really very typical of people who have suffered from depression. I think Zen is really dealing with this problem. It's really teaching people, look, you don't have to be powerless. You don't have to be paralyzed. You imagine there's no solution, but tap into this dragon, part of yourself. There's a dragon in there that you can tap into. You know, and it sounds preposterous. But you know, you might sit down on the cushion one day and just suddenly feel this extraordinary happiness and connectedness and energy. This somebody the other day, I said, how was your sit? And she said, fantastic. You know, last night, there was a woman who doesn't usually come to the Saturday sit, but she comes on Fridays and sometimes. And I said, how was your sit? And she said, oh my God. She said, is there anything better than Mu? And I said, no. But she had been there, right? You know, you basically, the small mind is pushed aside, and you get into this other, this energy, this other intelligence, which isn't a self-doubting intelligence. It's naturally active and spontaneous. I've mentioned this before, but there's a wonderful Zen story about a millipede. You know, there was a little millipede who would walk along the ground, and he would just run here and run there and run here and run there for years. I don't really know how old millipedes get, but he would just run around. He was a millipede. He was living a millipede's life. One day he came up to an ant, and the ant looked at him and said, how do you move all those legs? And he started thinking about it, and he suddenly was paralyzed, and he died. Right? because it became impossible to move his legs, right? Once he started thinking about how difficult it was. This is so right, isn't it? You know, when I was in graduate school, I was working on my dissertation, and I would just lie awake at night. I couldn't figure out where I was going. And, you know, I had a fellowship, so I had time off to write this thing. And, I knew when my time was up, you know, I was going to have a very difficult life. So, you know, I wanted it to be at least finished, and I wanted it to be good, and I just felt like I was wandering through this maze, you know, of ideas, and I couldn't get anywhere. And I'd write page after page and think, where is this going? If you've ever seen the movie The Shining, I felt like I was the guy in The Shining, you know. I would go to sit, and one morning Genki Roshi said at our Zendo, he said, life is impossible, you know. So you have to live, right? And I just thought, yes, yes, you know. That's it exactly. You know, there's this other way to live. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to call moo, and the self-doubting mind begins to grow quiet, we open the door to this spontaneous unconscious mind, which is creative, world-embracing, compassionate, and unafraid. And we learn, you know, practicing hour after hour after hour, day after day after day, is really learning how to get in touch with this mind, and then learning how to trust it, to act from this place. You know, so basically, sometimes when we have to act, we're filled with self-doubt, you know. Sometimes, though, you know, when we act, if we act spontaneously, there's this tremendous energy and joy, right? It's difficult. You know, I had to do the Mu Koan for 5 years. I'm not kidding. There's people in our group who have been doing the Mu Koan for a year, and they look very sulky and unhappy sometimes. Like, oh my God, I've been working on this koan for a year. You know, it's like, I had to do the Mu Koan for 5 years, and that's like sitting in a closet at a dark room for 5 years. And I would go in for 5 years to see Genki Roshi, and he would say, no, 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 sorry, no, 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 no. And, you know, I was a very good student in high school. I always got A's. If I didn't get A's, I was unhappy. So I was getting like F's in my Zen practice. Basically, yeah, psychologically, this was very, very painful for me. You know, and I would try so hard. I really sort of plunged into despair after a while. At first I was mad, and then I was in despair. And I, for some reason, I didn't quit doing Zen. I think it still made me feel better, but I couldn't solve this problem. And I finally gave up. I thought, well, I'll just practice Zen. I don't know when I'll stop. I'll go to Sesshin. You know, I'll probably never solve the Mu Koan. You know, and all my friends were moving on to more advanced koans. At the end of every Sesshin, everybody would look so happy, you know. Like, I solved my koan, you know. And I would just think, ah, oh, another Sesshin where I haven't solved my koan. And it was very difficult for me, you know. And I really did just give up. And then, you know, one day we had a sesshin in the fall at our temple up in the mountains. And we couldn't really use it in the winter because the snow was too heavy, but we didn't have a proper dokusan room, so Genki Roshi would sit in the kitchen. Basically, he'd sit in the kitchen, and there was a big stove in the kitchen, it was great. You could go in and warm up. And the Dokusan line was outside the kitchen on this pathway that was covered with wood chips, and we would just sit there, and the snow would build up on people's shoulders. I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I just opened my mouth and called Mu, and it was so wonderful, that energy. It was just astoundingly, it was just astonishing to me. You know, where did that come from? You know, where did that energy come from? And it really made me a believer. You know, I thought, maybe Genki's right. You know, maybe there is this depth inside of me. There is this other mind, you know. This is what Zen is all about, tapping this deeper intelligence and trusting it and allowing this natural spontaneity to guide us, right? And not always trying to think things through. Not always trying to think things through. So this story of Jojo Za is about somebody who's been trapped, like me, with Mu Koan. He's been a monk for 20-some, 30 years, something like that. And he's probably, every time he sits down, he probably has a lot of self-doubt and self-loathing, fear, and so on and so on. And he's never been able to trust this mind, to get in touch with his deeper mind. And so he goes to Rinzai, and he says, you know, what is Buddhism all about? And Rinzai doesn't say, oh dear, I'm not a very good teacher. Here this poor guy has been studying with me for 20 years and he hasn't answered his koan. I'm a really lousy teacher. Maybe I should just retire. You know, maybe there's somebody else who can do a better job. You know, what should I do? You know, Rinzai doesn't react that way. He trusts that spontaneity, and he jumps off the chair, slaps the guy, and the man is frozen. Right? He's just frozen. And this is so important. It's like all thought ceases. You know, that self-doubting mind is silenced. And this is the silence we confront when we're facing Mu on the cushion. You know, when we sit, you know, eventually, if you keep doing the Mu Koan, you reach this point where thought stops. And it's like staring into a cave, right? This is, when this happens to you, this is so important. You know, this is looking face to face at Mu, face to face at the unconscious. And basically, Jojo Za is in that place now, maybe for the first time in 30 years. And the monk next to him says, why don't you bow? And Jojo Za bows. Now, this is like natural action from this place. Natural action from this place, and he has his great awakening experience. So you know, basically, this is the difference between Zen and Vipassana, is that we have this whole idea of unconscious mind. You know, it is true that there are layers to the unconscious mind. So you know. We all have in the unconscious mind these elements that are toxic elements, you could say. So we all have phobias and we all have trauma. You know, we've all probably been through traumatic events that have left scars on us. We all have certain kinds of pathologies. That's actually so, you know. Most people have some kind of personality disorder. I think that's actually so, you know. And we don't always understand it. We may not even be aware of it, you know. But there are many layers to the unconscious, but at the core of the unconscious, we believe, is this pure, radiant awareness, which is absolutely compassionate. And that you can trust 100%. 100%. The problem is just learning how to trust. You know, I believe very much in this. You know, I think that the mind has a self-healing capacity, which is quite remarkable. You know, I have known people who have known people who have been through really difficult lives. And they are just really amazing people. And you think, how did they do that? How did they do that? How did they overcome that? I think the mind, this core mind, has this amazing self-healing property. I think that therapy is a wonderful thing. Therapy is wonderful, and I think what a good therapist does is to use the self-healing power of the mind. I think part of what a therapist is doing is encouraging you to trust the self-healing power of your own mind, this deeper mind that isn't the self-doubting mind. You know, I think a bad therapist would say something like, no, break off that relationship, don't have anything to do with him again, right? That's actually disempowering, right? I mean, I think a good therapist would say, well, how do you feel about this relationship, you know? And you might spend several sessions just thinking about your own reactions to the relationship. And you might say at first, well, I love him or I love her. And then, you know, you sit with that for a while. You might not be in Zazen, but you're sitting with that for a while and you realize, well, I don't know if I love her. I actually just am afraid of being alone, right? And then you sit with that for a little while and you go, well, actually, I don't even think she's a very nice person, but I'm really afraid of being alone, right? And then you sit with that a little bit and you realize, you know, I don't want to be alone, but maybe I don't want to be with this person, you know? And so on. And I think the therapist doesn't tell you that. The therapist lets you trust, gives you, helps you to trust the self-healing power of the mind more fully. You know, so even though people think the therapist is doing it, and the therapist is very good and very important, it's really your own, a good therapist knows that you heal yourself. You know, you heal yourself. There's a mind that already knows the answer to all this. You know, we just don't trust it. And so a lot of Zen practice is sitting in that mind, you know. There's a mind that knows that fundamentally there's no problem, actually. At the core of the mind, there's a mind that knows that fundamentally there's no problem. In the Lankavatara Sutra, which is a very important sutra for the Zen school, the teaching is, you know, the reality is really like the blue sky. There's no boundaries. There's no obstacles. All of the boundaries and obstacles we ourselves have created. We ourselves have created. And so Jojo Za, you know, he created his own obstacles, his own barriers. He said, you know, every day that Jojo Za didn't have enlightenment, he felt worse and worse about himself. And he looked around at all these people who had this experience, and he kept saying, okay, today I've got to do it. Today I've got to do it. And at the end of every day, of course, he didn't do it. You know, and this goes on for 30 years, and basically Jojo Za becomes mentally ill, you know, as we all are to some degree, you know, just absolutely paralyzing self-doubt. And he says to Rinzai, help me, help me. How do I get out of this? And Rinzai slaps him and acts spontaneously from that place, and Jojo Za, suddenly his mind is empty. And the guy says, bow, why don't you bow? And Jojo Za doesn't say, should I bow? What will they think of me if I... He just bows. And it's like a door in himself opening up. When we can contact this mind and act from this place, we feel like we're authorized by the universe to do what we're doing, right? And this confidence, this is like FDR's confidence, right? We suddenly feel like, you know, this is going to work out. This is going to work out. This is going to work out. You know, that trust is difficult. But every morning at Sesshin and here on Saturdays, we recite verses on the heart-mind. And that's actually a mistranslation. It's actually trust in mind. That's actually the correct. And it's sometimes translated as faith in mind, which is okay too. But you say faith in mind, what's that all about? It's faith in the unconscious, in this dynamic unconscious mind, the self-healing, self-healing mind. Yeah. We don't trust it, but if we practice Zen, we begin to trust it. And it's hard. I mean, Zen practice. The reason people sit down on the cushion and they don't have enlightenment experience immediately is that they just don't trust themselves, because fundamentally enlightenment is already there. It's only self-doubt that makes it unreachable for us. The self-healing mind is enlightenment. So one way to think about Zen is that we are already, there is a part of you that is guiding you towards enlightenment all the time. All the time. Every day, every minute, you know, there's something that is looking after you, that loves you, that is caring for you, and that is deeply connected to the world, right? I remember once going to a... I'll stop. I know this is going on for a long time. We used to have our sesshins up at this mountain temple, the sesshin where I solved the mukon, where I finally opened up to the mukon, my wife came in our little beat-up Volkswagen to pick me up. Now, we were so poor in those days, we didn't even have like a record player. But my wife had bought a little tape player, that, you know, and she was listening to a tape by a group called The Police. And there's a song, they have a song called Every Step You Take, you know, I am watching you, right? You know. Well, inside yourself, there's a little, you know, every step you take, every vow you break, blah, 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 I am watching you, you know. There's an intelligence, there's a dragon watching you. And you can't go wrong if you trust it. Just, you know, Zen is the practice of trust. You know, and if you just practice trust, you know, things are going to go really well. That's the teaching. So, you know, it's, why not give it a try? And it helps greatly to do your zazen, to sit down on the cushion. This is the very essence of trust, right? I'm going to sit down on this cushion with my legs crossed, watching my breath, and somehow enlightenment is going to appear. What a beautiful expression of trust. Okay. Main subject. Jojoza asks Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojoza stood still. A monk standing by said, Jojoza, why don't you bow? Jojoza bowed, and he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Dansai, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the yellow river run through.